Good morning. My name is Lee Hinman. Peggy and I are part of the cafe team. We're part of a small group at the church. Occasionally I get to be up here and look at all your wonderful faces as I sing. Today I get to read in chapter 16, we're going to read the parable of the dishonest manager. He also said to the disciples, "There was a rich man who had a manager, and charges were brought to him that this man was wasting his possessions. And he called him and said to him, 'What is this I hear about you? Turn in the account of your management, for you can no longer be a manager.' And the manager said to himself, 'What shall I do, since my master is taking the management away from me? I'm not strong enough to dig, and I am ashamed to beg. I have decided what to do, so that when I am removed from management, people may receive me into their houses.' So summoning his master's debtors, one by one, he said to the first, 'How much do you owe my master?' He said, 100 measures of oil. And he said to him, 'Take your bill and sit down quickly and write 50. Then he said to another, "And how much do you owe?" He said, 100 measures of wheat. He said to him, "Take your bill and write 80. The master commended the dishonest manager for his shrewdness, for the sons of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than the sons of light. And I tell you, make friends for yourselves by means of unrighteous wealth, so that when it fails, they may receive you into the eternal dwellings. One who is faithful in very little is also faithful in much. And one who is dishonest in very little is also dishonest in much. If then you have not been faithful in the unrighteous wealth, who will entrust you the true riches? And if you have not been faithful in that which is another's, who will give you that which is your own? No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money."
Thanks, Lee. So we are continuing along in our series in the book of Luke, and we hear that phrase at the end, and it's a fairly popular phrase from Jesus: "You cannot serve both God and money." Now, I know this might make some of us get our hackles up, like, why are we talking about money today? Well, here's the thing about Luke 16. The entire thing is about money. You look at verse 1, which Lee just read for us, and this parable is about this rich man. And you read throughout the story, and he doesn't seem to be a good guy in the story. Now, granted, no one is in this parable. But you also read a little further on to verse 14, and Luke steps in, the author of this book, and he gives us a little bit of instruction about the Pharisees, the religious leaders at the time, and says that they are lovers of money. And they ridicule Jesus for how he's teaching them how to use money. Then you get to verse 19, and Jesus tells another parable about a rich man, and he very much so is not the good guy in the story. And so throughout this entire chapter, Jesus keeps coming back to this topic of money. In particular, how Christians, how his disciples, how people following him are to treat, are to view, are to interact with money. And so let's jump into it so that way we can see, what is it that Jesus is teaching us? What is it that he's trying to tell his followers of how to view money, how to view wealth? And to do that, he tells a parable. This is verse 1. This is Jesus, "also said to the disciples, 'There was a rich man who had a manager, and charges were brought against him that this man was wasting his possessions. And he called him and said to him, "What is this that I hear about you? Turn in the account of your management, for you are no longer, for you can no longer be manager.'" All right, so a reminder that this is coming out of Luke 15. Luke 16 follows Luke 15. And in Luke 15, Jesus is talking. He's giving an account to the Pharisees who are asking him, "Why are you spending so much time with sinners and tax collectors? Why are you spending time with those who are viewed so poorly in society? Aren't you supposed to be this good, holy man? Why are you interacting with them?" And so out of that, Jesus gives three parables, these stories that he makes up. They don't actually happen, but he's making making up these stories to make a point. And so he gives these three parables to the Pharisees, to the religious leaders, to answer that question. Why am I spending time with tax collectors and sinners? So he talks about a lost sheep, a lost coin, a lost son. And he gives these parables to the Pharisees to say, this is why I'm doing it. This is what my mission is. I have come for the lost. But now Jesus turns. And now he's talking to the disciples, to those who are following him, to those who are seeking to live in the way that he's calling them to live. This isn't to the Pharisees anymore, who are out on the outside grumbling, wondering, why are you doing things? This is to his followers, to those who are near him, and saying, if you are one of those lost who have been found, if you are seeking to follow after me, this is how we are to deal with wealth, to deal with money. And so it's a turn to all of us in here who are also disciples to teach us. This isn't so much for all of the world to operate in this way, but if you are seeking to follow Jesus, this is what he is saying his followers ought to do with money, ought to view money. And so he tells this parable of this wealthy man. Now, this would have had a response from Jesus' followers. He had very few disciples who were wealthy at the time. And in fact, most of the people that he was with, those sinful people, those laborers that gravitated towards Jesus, they would have viewed the wealthy in a not so favorable light. The thinking was at the time, well, your money had to come from somewhere. And most often it came at the expense of others or exploiting others. And as we find out a little bit later of how much he's owed, doesn't really seem like there's everything above board with how he is making his money. And so they would have heard this and they would have had a thought about him as a wealthy man to begin with. But then we get a little bit of detail about him. That this wealthy man has a manager. This is someone who would oversee his estate and finances, either while he's away or while he's dealing and caring for a bigger piece of property, a bigger estate. And he's got this manager that he gets this negative report about. He has been wasteful of your possessions. So he calls him in and he says, what is this I hear about you? Not, what is this that I know to be true? What is this that I discovered about you? What is this that I've looked into and I found out it's actually happened? Nope, just someone told me something bad about you, so turn in the account, turn in the books, pack a box, you're fired. It certainly doesn't seem like he's acting like a good guy in the story. He hears this report about the manager and fires him on the spot about it. All because he's worried. What if I'm losing out on money? What if I'm losing out on property? That is his focus here. But we don't see the manager defend himself. We would think if it was a false report, he would have been, no, hear me out. I'm innocent. I didn't do it. He doesn't do anything like that. So maybe the report's true. It ultimately doesn't matter. What Jesus wants to focus on is how does this manager respond? The end is coming. He is losing his job, so what does he do about it? This is verse 3. And the manager said to himself, what shall I do since my master is taking the management away from me? I'm not strong enough to dig. I'm ashamed to beg. I've decided what I will do so that when I'm removed from management, people may receive me into their houses. So, like we said, the manager doesn't defend himself. Instead, he's coming up with a plan. I see the incoming. I'm about to lose my job. What can I do now to set me up better for the future? What is it that I can do while I still have this position? What is it that I can do to be friendly, to make friends, so that way I am cared for after I get fired, after I lose my position? And so he comes up with a plan of how he can, what he could do now to care, set himself up better in the future. And this is his plan. In verse 5, he said, so, summoning his master's debtor one by one, he said to the first, how much do you owe my master? And he said, 100 measures of oil. And he said to him, take your bill, sit down quickly, and write 50. So cut it in half. And he said to another, how much do you owe? He said, 100 measures of wheat. And he said to him, take your bill, write down 80. So we see this plan that he puts in place of how he can, what he can do now to set himself up for a better future. So before he is fired, before he has to give back the books of the account, before he has to return the books, he cooks them. He acts in a way that is cutting the debts that these people owe so that they might look upon him favorably. While he still has this position, he is acting now to set himself up for a better future. And we see this first person who is in debt to the master come in. And he says, well, how much do you owe? And he says, 100 measures of oil. You may have a footnote in your Bible, or maybe not. Well, it tells us that it's about 875 gallons of olive oil. Maybe that's still a number that we can't quite wrap our minds around. We're used to a recipe calling for a tablespoon of olive oil. So this could, with this amount of oil, you can make just over 211,000 recipes. That is a tremendous amount of oil. Like, it is a ridiculous amount of debt this man is in. And so that's the debt that he has. That's a huge amount. To think of him owing one person that amount is unfathomable. From what we could tell at the time, that amount of olive oil would have been worth about 1,000 denarii. We talked last week about a denarii. It was a coin that was used at the time that a laborer, after working one day, would be given a denarii, a coin that represents about one day's wage. We saw in the parable of the lost coin, this woman had 10 and she lost one and did everything in her power to find this coin. It was that valuable to her. This person is in debt 1,000 of those, as best we can tell. It's about 3 years' wage. Can you imagine being in debt to someone 3 years of your 3 years' worth of your annual income? To think of how catastrophic that would be, about how insurmountable that must be. And now you're called in by the manager, the person who's representing the one you owe the debt to. That's got to be such an anxious moment, right? Is this debt going to be called in? Might I have to pay this in full? Where is this money going to come from? And then to have the relief when this person, with the flick of a pen, with a single stroke, cuts that in half. That is such a relief. How grateful must this person be towards this manager? And that's the point. The manager is doing what he can. He's doing what he still has the ability to do. He's working now to ensure that he has a better future. The second debtor comes in. How much do you owe? Well, 100 measures of wheat. Let me make sure I get the wording right. 100 measures of wheat. This is an even bigger debt. 100 measures of wheat is the yield from about 100 acres of farmland. So to pay this off, you would need a piece of property just a little bit smaller than Carpenter Park to pay off the debt, let alone the fact that most farms at the time were about 5 acres. You need 100 acres of farmland just to pay off the debt, let alone what you need to survive, to feed your family. And this manager says, take that number and write 80. Again, that's about the same amount, 100 denarii that was saved to this person. Imagine in one moment, 1.5 years of your annual income that you owed someone, it's just removed. That debt is gone. You've been freed of that. Think of how grateful this person must have been towards this manager. And that's the point. He is doing whatever he can. He is ingratiating himself with these debtors. He's doing whatever he can while he still has time. He sees this incoming. He is getting fired. So he's doing what he can now to set himself up for a better future. And then verse 8 gets to the point of this. Why is Jesus telling this parable? Verse 8 says, the master commended the dishonest manager for his shrewdness. For the sons of the world are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than the sons of light. And I tell you, make friends for yourself by means of unrighteous wealth, so that when it fails, they may receive you into the eternal dwellings. It's a really tough section to understand, and yet it's so crucial to understanding, why did Jesus tell this story? What is his point? What is he teaching his disciples of how to view money, how to handle wealth? And one of the difficult ways, the first difficult way to understand this passage is the response of the master. He fires this manager for being wasteful of his possessions. And then that manager goes out and he's even more wasteful of his possessions. He is costing him a small fortune by going out and canceling a portion of these debts. And so he's doing the very thing that he was fired for, and the response of this wealthy man is to commend him? What's going on with that? Well, I think of it like in, it happens in a variety of things, but I think in particular mob movies, if you ever watch any of those, where you have that time where this guy went against the mob boss. Maybe he boldly demanded something of him, or he cut himself out of a deal, which you never do with this guy. Don't you remember scene one where that happened and that guy got in a lot of trouble for doing it? And so this guy has been going against the mob boss and he's sat down in front of him, surrounded by his goons, just sweating profusely, and the camera keeps cutting back and forth between him, terrified, and the mob boss, who's got this really serious look on his face. And then it's broken by him smiling. He's like, I like this guy. Oh, the nerve on him. And then he's told, you know, don't ever do this again, but he's allowed to go free. And he walks out just breathing, like, can't believe his luck. We see in that moment that this man acted dishonorably to a mob boss, to someone who always acts dishonorably, and yet the response that he had was, you know, well played. I like how you handled that. And he's allowed to go free. I think that's what we have here. This wealthy man is someone who doesn't act honorably often. And he has this manager who's out scrambling to do whatever he can. He's acting with urgency, acting very ingeniously to try to secure a future for himself, doing a rather dishonorable thing for him. And the reaction from the owner is, I like this guy. The nerve on him to go and act in this way, to go and quickly try to find a solution for yourself. You know, well played. You're still getting fired, but well played. I think that's what we have going on here is he acts in a way to where the only response that the owner has, even though he lost out on a lot of resources, is just to commend him, to say the nerve on him. But he played that situation really well. And then we get to the teaching of Jesus, of what is it that he's telling his disciples in this. The second part of verse 8, it seems to break away from the parable. It seems like the parable is ended, and now it's Jesus teaching on the parable, because he's the only one who uses these phrases. He says, for the sons of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than the sons of light. So we have this parable. This man sees an incoming and he goes out and he cuts debts so that people would receive him better. He does what he still can with his time to set him up for a future, a better future. And he's commended for his shrewdness. And now Jesus teaches on this shrewdness. He says, the sons of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their generation than the sons of light. And these are phrases that Jesus uses to talk about two different groups of people. The sons of the world are those who do not follow Jesus. They would not be his disciples. They don't see the life and hope and peace and joy that comes from following him. Instead, these are people who see this world as all there is, that they are trying to set themselves up for a better life right now because they don't see anything beyond the horizon. And meanwhile, the sons of light is an expression that Jesus uses at times to talk about his disciples. The very people that he is teaching. But he's saying, these people who aren't following me, they're better than you in this way. They're more shrewd than you. And it's really interesting to try to understand this. And I think the point of this is we got to follow the line of thinking from the manager. He saw the end coming. He was getting fired. He saw the end coming and did everything in his power to set up a future. It was causing him to act with urgency, to try to find a way to set himself up for a better future. Yes, he acted despicably. He lied. He cheated his boss out of this. He's doing things in a really despicable way. And yet, with that end in mind, he's doing whatever he can with all urgency to set himself up for a better future. How he is acting now will make things better for him to come. And so the implication, if that's what those in this world, those who don't have a hope for the future, if they live in such a way with such urgency, Jesus is saying they act in a more shrewd way than the sons of light do. So what's the implication of this? It's essentially Jesus saying, you, disciple, you who claim to be following me, you who seek to live your life for me, why don't you live with such urgency? Why don't you use what you have now, your time, your resources, your talents, your abilities, why don't you use what you have now to have an impact on your future, both yours and those around you? Not just focused on this life that you have now, but on the eternal dwellings, on the life that is to come. Why aren't you living in such a way now that is setting you up for your future as well? Why do non-Christians look after their physical needs with more urgency, with more commitment, than Christians look after their spiritual needs? I mean, think about it. Think about what we say we have in Jesus. In him, we have life. Where once before we were lost and aimless, but in him we have been found. Before we were directionless without a purpose, but in him we have hope and a future. We have joy. And so why does that not impact us? Why are those without the hope of Jesus acting more shrewdly, doing whatever they can to set themselves up for this life that they think is the only life that they have? Why aren't Christians living in a way where they are so impacted by the future hope that is to come, that they are living in such a way that is building towards that is directing towards that? Why aren't they using what they have now to set themselves up for their future, them and those who are around them? And when we see this comparison between the sons of light and the sons of the world, between Christians and non-Christians, don't we still see a bit of a deviation between them? Don't we still see a difference in what Christians are doing for their eternal future compared to what non-Christians are doing to set themselves up for a better life now? Let me talk about it in just a couple ways. Why is it that on average, Christians read less of their Bible than other people read reviews on an air fryer that they're about to buy, or Yelp reviews for a restaurant, or really anything for that matter? Christians claim that this is the very word; these are the very words of God that shape and guide and direct us, and yet we commit to reading it less than we would a pamphlet or instructions or whatever it may be. Why is it that Christians spend less time being shaped by what God has said than what other people do for reading anything else? Comment boards, whatever it might be. Why is it that on average, Christians spend less time praying than other people might spend daydreaming about a better life? Man, wouldn't it be great to win $1 billion in the lottery? Wouldn't it be great to have this job or this car or this item that I have? Why do Christians spend less time praying, which we say actually changes things, than daydreaming about what a better life might be like, which can't actually change anything? Why are the sons of this world more shrewd, more diligent, with more urgency, working to secure them a better life now, which will end, which there is much outside of their power, than Christians do living in a way that secures their eternal future, them and those around them? So, and again, none of this is to earn God's love, but those of us who have received God's love, those of us who have received this life, those of us who see that there's a life that is to come, an eternal reality, that Jesus has come and that changed everything. Why does that have little impact on our lives now? Because far too often, our lives end up looking like everyone else's, doesn't it? That we too can be easily focused on just what we have, just what's physical and tangible around us. That we too can just mirror what everyone is doing around us. How can I find security now? How can I make things better now? How can I do whatever needs to happen so that my life now is better? And yet, there's a warning that's given for us from Jesus. This was verse 13 again. No servant can serve two masters. For either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money. What is our driving force? What is it that shapes our decision? What is it that shapes how we are living? Is it just to amass more in this life? Is it just to find security and comfort in this life? Then we are serving the false god of money. Or are we looking towards an eternal future? And what we are doing now is based off of that. What we are doing now in our lives and the lives of us, those around us, is geared towards the new heavens and the new earth that's to come. And we are focused in how we are living now to impact our future that is to come. And then from that we get a confusing command. Now, I know how this might sound. We're talking so much about money, and churches seem to talk about money all the time, and now there's this command about what I'm supposed to do with it, and there's this worry that what is it that I'm supposed to give up for Jesus? The command is actually a bit more difficult and a bit softer than we might think. How do we live now? What is it that Jesus tells us to do? How are we to view money? What is this command that he gives as people seeking to be his disciples, seeking to follow him? How is it that we are supposed to live? Well, his command comes in verse 9, and he says, make friends. That's the command. Jesus says, make friends. Now, to my fellow introverts in here, yeah, that sounds like the most difficult command in the entire Bible. But it's a little bit different than that. Because look at the whole sentence. Make friends for yourself by means of unrighteous wealth. How are we supposed to view money? Make friends for yourself by means of unrighteous wealth. And so the question that comes from this, the instruction that comes to this is seeing that the parable is key. What is Jesus telling us to do? Well, the parable is key to understanding what it is that he's saying. There was this manager. The end was coming for him. He was fired. And so he did everything in his power with urgency, with as much work as he could to set himself up for a better future. Yes, he made things easier on other people, but we can certainly not say he was doing it to be friends with them. He was taking these people and putting them in his debt as well. After he lost his job, he could show up at their doorstep and saying, hey, is it cool if I crash here for a few months or so? I mean, after all, I did just save you a lot of money. But he did what he could with how he handled money to, in a sense, make friends. And so those of us who are seeking to follow Jesus, those who are seeking to live for the eternity that he has in place for his followers, for those who believe in him, there is an end coming for us all as well. An end of all wealth. All money will fail. It said that in verse 9. Wealth will fail. It will cease to exist. There is this world that we live in right now where it's so easy for us to get fixated on what's tangible, what's in front of us. This world will give way to the new heavens and the new earth. And so what are we doing now, in this place now, to live with our focus towards eternity? There is an end coming. Are we living with that end in mind? And so are we using money? Are we using wealth with all the urgency as those who don't know Jesus, with all the urgency of the sons of this world to set themselves up for a better life now? Are we in with the same urgency using wealth but towards an eternal future, ours and those around us? And Jesus says, make friends by use of unrighteous wealth. This title of unrighteous wealth, it goes to the idea that money can actually steer us away from God? Why does he say you cannot serve both God and money? Because money is one of the key ways that can cause us to drift away from him. That when we have it, we think that we can solve all of our problems. When we have it, we think that we can set ourselves up with security, with a future. When we have it, we think that we have the means to make life go smooth. Or when we don't have it, it's the pursuit of getting it. It can pull us away from God. You cannot serve both God and money. Hey, and so certainly there are people in this room who do not have enough money or feel they do not have enough money. There are debts. There are bills that come in and they are difficult to pay, let alone bills are becoming more and more expensive. And so the question goes to it, is your focus on acquiring, on getting more? Is your focus on thinking that if I just had more money, then that would make all things better? So is our interaction with money just trying to get more, trying to find some sort of hope that we think comes from money? Well, the warning is wealth will fail. So any sort of hope that we find, well, that will be temporary as well. Or on the other side of that, there are some in this room who find security and comfort, maybe even status in money, that we have emergency funds, 401ks. We have money that we set aside to go on a vacation that we're desperately looking forward to because we don't do a good enough job finding rest during the week. We have things that we want, things that we think that we need. And again, having our mind focused on these things are not necessarily bad, but what is my focus? Is it that if I could just get more, then that would make me feel safe? If I just had more money, then my life would truly be comfortable. Is that the focus of how we use money? But we're told it will fail, that there's an incoming, that it will go away. So any comfort, any status that comes from money, well, that will just be temporary too. Because all it takes is something to change. For a bubble to burst. For the stock market to crash. For inflation to hit. For a rampant bird flu. For natural gas shortages. All it takes is something like that to come along, and then all that wealth that we've put in it, our hopes or our comfort and our security, well, it just goes away. So what then does Jesus say is our focus to be? If this money is going to fail, if it can make us turn and drift away from God because we think that we can solve our own issues, how then do we respond to money? Make friends. Make friends by use of unrighteous money. How we are living now matters for the future. And so the question goes to, are we valuing people more than we are valuing the things that we have? Are we valuing others more than we value this money that's just going to go away anyways? Does this mentality that Jesus gives to his disciples to use money to make friends, rather than turning away from God, instead use this to make friends, does that show up in how we live, how we treat others? Does it show up in how hospitable we are to others? How willing we are to use that to show kindness and grace and mercy to other people? Does it show up in who we are hospitable to? Or all of our interactions just with people that fall within our same tax bracket? Does it show up in how willing we are to try to be part of removing obstacles and hardships from the lives of others? Does how we treat people, is how we treat people the primary way that we view any money that's been given to us? It's going away. So how might we value relationships? How might we use this opportunity to show that there is an eternity coming, to show that there has been grace that's given to us, and we want to use this money to make friends now, to show the hope that is to come? This money's going away anyways, so how can it be used to help others see the grace and mercy that God gives to us? Are we living this way? The second question of that is, are we budgeting this way? Or do we just operate out of the margins? Is this something that's a priority for us, or is it just, you know, if I can help, then we'll see. Is this a priority? This wealth that can cause us to drift from God, this wealth that will not last forever, is our focus on just creating more comfort here? Or do we see it as the means to create, to make friends with our eyes focused to eternity? I want to soften this a little bit because I know how this might sound. The first way I want to soften this is I hope you hear how many times I use the word we, because this is very much so still a learning place for me. I'm a saver to a fault, I guess you could say. That when Emily and I got married, I pretty quickly forced her to start using a budgeting app so that way we can make sure we are keeping to our budget areas in every place that we had. And then from that budgeting app, I would import that into a spreadsheet so I could track monthly expenditures as well. And then there's a second part of the spreadsheet that tracks year-to-year spending. But my focus is on all of that. And certainly, we have a budget category for giving, for donations. So, but how often does it come to my mind that this is a part of us willingly sacrificing what God has given us, willingly surrendering something that we could use in a variety of ways? How often does the sacrifice come to mind in that? How often does the priority show up that we want to be about this? We want to be using what God has given us to make friends, to care for others, to point them to Jesus. And it's kind of just ended up as a cell on a spreadsheet for me. It's another budget category. It's right next to groceries. It's kind of just seen in the same way. And as well, as I said, I'm a saver to a fault. Any margin that we have, I want to put that away. There's even a part of me that really dislikes using our emergency fund, even in the event of an emergency. Because, you know, what if we use it and then an emergency happens? None of these things are necessarily bad. I know we're called to be good stewards, and the Bible quite clearly tells us to be good stewards of who is in our life, of what's been given to us. And I think this is a way of doing that. Please don't start doing spreadsheets. I mean, if you want to, we can. I think it's a good thing to be caring for what God has given me, caring for the people in my life. But it's so easy for that to turn into me holding on to it with a clenched fist. That my comfort in life, how I'm doing, well, it's all based off of what numbers in that savings account. How I'm doing now, if things are going well for us, well, it all depends on how much security I'm finding in resources and finances. And that is where I'm finding comfort here. And yet, what we're told here is that it will fail. Every account will be drained. Every fund will disappear. Every piggy bank will be broken. And so how are we using what we have now, with that end coming, focused towards eternity, both for ours and those around us? How can that be our priority as people following Jesus? And how can we use what's been given to us to make friends, to point them to Jesus as well? Second part to soften this. Yes, this is a command given to the disciples, individually, to every person. And I think every person in this room can grow in this area. And yet I do want to point out that you all are doing this collectively as a church. I think of Heart of Advent. It's a giving project that we do at the end of every year to remind ourselves that in this time of spending, of buying gifts, that there is more to this season than that. That so much has been given to us in Jesus coming into this world. And so we want to give back. We want to use what we have to make friends. What we got some totals back, and you, along with the two other campuses in Boulder and Erie, you all raised a little over $155,000, which is incredible. And this money is going to go to multiply the church in Ukraine, in our local community, in our town even, to help try to use that money, which could steer us away from God, but to try to use this money to multiply the church, to try to make his name known, to use what we have to make friends and point them to the hope and mercy and grace that we find in Jesus. And in all that we do, none of it is just to bring in buckets of money. But the focus with anything that we do is to do this, to make friends, to show them some of the hope that we find in Jesus, to show them that there is something on the horizon, that this life is not just it. Because yes, if that was the case, then act like the manager. As shrewdly as you can, amass what you can for this life, because that's all there is to come. But that isn't the case. We do have hope. We do have life that is to come. So how do we live now in a way that reflects that? How do we live now in a way that sets ourselves and others around us up for that eternal future to come? Because if we don't live this way, if we don't view money this way, if we don't use it to make friends, do we really think that end is coming? Do we really think there's something more than just this life? Do we really have hope for a future to come? Do we really think that there is a heaven and a hell? Do we really think that there is a future to be had? Well, that's next week's message. There's too much in chapter 16, so we're gonna save it. Maybe you're disappointed that we didn't talk about the other peculiar parable in this chapter. We will. We'll talk about it next week. But in the meantime, I want to focus on what is that command from Jesus? How do we view this money? What are we to do with it? Well, we are to make friends. This wealth that can cause us to drift from God, instead, how can we use it with eternity in mind? To make friends, to help build towards our eternal future and those around us. And it doesn't say it here, but I want to leave us with this little bit. Why? Why do we view wealth in that way? Why are we to live in this way? The motivation isn't in this chapter. I mean, yeah, the money's going to fail. That can be a motivation, but we miss the greatest motivation. Because if you keep reading through the Gospel of Luke, we see what it is that Jesus gave to call you his friend. We use our wealth to make friends. And yet, as we continue to read the Gospel of Luke, we see what Jesus gave with no obligation to do so. What he surrendered when we were unable to draw near to him, he drew near to us. That he has come into this world to pay it all, to give it all, so that you can be called sons and daughters, so that you can be called friend. Because he has sacrificed all of that, we live our lives in the same way. So that we can make friends, so that we can point others to the hope that we find in Jesus. That is how we view, are called to view money. Let me pray for us. Father, we are so grateful that you have come, that you have paid it all, that you have drawn near to us. We who were unable to draw near to you, you came. We who were unable to balance our books with you, you paid it all. And so we seek to live our lives reflecting who you are. We seek to live our lives shaped by you. It is easy for us to live in a way that looks like everyone around us. It is easy for us to live lives that seem no different than those who don't know you, that we're saying that we worship you, yes, but our lives don't always reflect that. And yet the call here is that it is impossible to serve both God and money. So help us, shape us, lead us to view money in the way that you call us to hold it loosely, to be good stewards of the people you've put in our life, to be wise with what you've given us, yes, but to be valuing others, to be valuing you greater than anything. Help us to look for opportunities that we might make friends. Help us to have our eyes focused on the horizon, the day that is to come, the new heavens and the new earth. Help us to be so full of the love that you pour out on us that it overflows onto others. That is how we wish to live. So it's to you and you alone that we pray. Amen.